failed to grasp the significance of Watergate, particularly in Europe and in the Arab world, where people viewed the president as a foreign policy genius, which in many ways he was. There was a lot we and the public still didn't know, but we were on the road to finding out, helped along in the spring of 1973 by a federal grand jury's indictment of former Attorney General John Mitchell and former Secretary of Commerce Maurice Stans on charges of conspiracy, perjury, and obstruction of justice for impeding an SEC investigation of international financier Robert Vesco in exchange for a secret Vesco contribution of $200,000 cash to Nixon's 1972 campaign. The televised Senate Watergate hearings and early calls for impeachment, coming from conservatives, including Barry Goldwater, as much as or more than from liberals, also helped. The continuing efforts of the Post, and finally other newspapers and other media as well, and the Congress and the courts, helped expose the size of the iceberg. There began a steady stream of revelations, with more and more evidence of scheming and political chicanery coming to light. Wiretaps of several journalists were revealed. We were told by many people that the Post's building was bugged, and even that I was being followed. Some of this was clearly an overreaction in an environment rife with paranoia. We did a sweep of our phones throughout the building and in my office and the offices of key editors, but turned up nothing. I'm fairly sure that my phones were never tapped, nor do I believe I was ever followed. But the atmosphere was so infected that this kind of suspicion didn't seem irrational at all. In June 1973, Woodward and Bernstein wrote that the White House had maintained a list of political enemies in 1971 and 1972, and the disclosure surprised few of us. By that time, many people, several of my friends among them, regarded it as an honor to be on it. The list was yet another sign of the peculiar mentality of the small group of men running the country. I can't remember whether my name actually appeared on it, but it was clear to me that I was on it whether my name was written down or not. A month later, a seismic Watergate event occurred. The turning point, the pivotal moment. In the course of his testimony before the Senate Investigating Committee, Alexander Butterfield, another Haldeman aide, revealed that there was a voice-activated recording system in the White House. Consequently, the vast majority of conversations the president had had in the Oval Office were on tape, a fact the president himself had clearly lost sight of, or perhaps he assumed that no one knew and that therefore the existence of the system would never become public knowledge. However, someone had to have installed this thing as well as run it, and that someone was Alexander Butterfield. As Woodward later said, it was yet another incredible sequence of events, and luck for us and bad luck for Nixon. Wrong decisions, wrong turns, but full disclosure of it hung by that fragile thread that could have been cut hundreds of times. Without the tapes, the true story would never have emerged. In fact, I believe that we at the Post were really saved in the end by the tapes and the lucky chance that they weren't destroyed. After the discovery of the tapes, people actually began waiting in the alley outside our building for the first edition of the paper, giving additional meaning to the phrase "hot off the presses." Everyone was now following the story. Who knows why Nixon didn't destroy the tapes? He seemed to think that they were valuable and that he could defend their privacy, which for a long time he tried to do. On July 25th, the president announced he would not release the tapes to Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, who had been appointed by Attorney General Elliot Richardson, because it would jeopardize the independence of the three branches of government. Unaccountably, during this time, I was still attempting to maintain relations even with Vice President Spiro Agnew, which in retrospect seems to me undignified, considering the awful slamming we were taking from him. I think my behavior was a combination of a rational idea that it was better to be talking to people who hated us or disapproved of us than not, and that good old-fashioned encumbrance of mine, the desire to please. Someone had sent me a funny photograph of an old shed somewhere in New York on which had been painted, "Ted Agnew likes Kay Graham, pass it on." I thought it was hilarious and did just that, passed it on to the vice president, saying, "I thought this sign might amuse you as it did me. The man who sent me the snapshot of the graffiti told me that the shed later burned, thus destroying the evidence. I guess things in life, or in graffiti, often come full circle. I promise to keep it a secret. Even more peculiarly, Agnew wrote back, I can find no fault with the sentiment of the graffiti. It is difficult to admire a newspaper that characterizes one as Caligula's horse, but I think you are charming. How embarrassing. A separate drama began unfolding around Agnew. Only 10 days after I had written him the sniveling little note, Agnew announced that he had been informed he was under investigation for possible violations of criminal law, and 2 days later, on August 8th, he held a press conference to trot out the usual denials of wrongdoings. As the investigation continued, the Post, on September 22nd, wrote that despite his statements that he would never quit, the vice president was plea bargaining. Agnew's lawyers tried to learn the source of certain damaging leaks by issuing subpoenas to Post reporter Richard Cohen and others who had been running stories about him. I later used quite plain language to describe what Agnew was trying to do. Freed of legalese, he wanted to know who in government was fingering him so he could deal with them personally or have the president fire them. The strategy our lawyers worked out to protect Cohen and the paper was to put all of his notes relating to Agnew in my possession, and in my affidavit to the court I asserted that I had ultimate responsibility for the custody of the notes. In fact, I was prepared to go to jail if need be to defend the notes and the source. This time, the possibility of jail seemed more realistic. I was traveling and called between planes to hear, with relief, that Agnew had pleaded no contest to one count of income tax evasion while governor of Maryland, which meant that I was off the hook. On October 10th, Spiro T. Agnew resigned as vice president. Meanwhile, President Nixon's troubles continued to mount, not helped at all by the Agnew crisis. On August 15th, he had made another televised speech, delivering his fifth major statement on Watergate, calling it a backward-looking obsession, and trying to deflect interest away from it by suggesting that the nation let the courts deal with it and turn its attention instead to matters of far greater importance. A week after that, on August 22nd, the same day Nixon made Kissinger Secretary of State following the resignation of Bill Rogers, he also accepted the blame for the White House climate that led to the break-in and the cover-up. Events were proceeding apace. On August 29th, Judge Sirica ordered the president to turn over to him for his private examination the tapes involving Watergate. Nixon and his lawyers appealed the order. The battle was joined in earnest when the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia upheld Sirica. Nixon then came up with the peculiar idea of providing tapes to the federal courts and Senate investigators with a personally prepared summary to be verified by Senator John Stennis. Special Prosecutor Cox, rightly, rejected the idea. The next day, October 20th, Cox defended his decision not to compromise with the president about the tapes. That night, the Buchwalds had arranged a tennis party for Art's birthday. Several of us were either already at or on our way to an indoor tennis court when we heard the stunning news of what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Attorney General Richardson had been told by the president to fire Cox. When he refused, he himself was fired. Richardson's deputy, Bill Ruckelshaus, also refused to fire Cox, and he too was fired. Finally, the third-ranking officer at the Justice Department, Robert Bork, consented to and did fire Cox. By that point, every journalist had left Art's party to head back to work. So dramatic and unexpected were the events that night that we were all really shaken. It's hard to realize now how fast everything was unfolding. With Leon Jaworski succeeding Cox as special prosecutor, the House Judiciary Committee met to consider impeachment proceedings against Nixon. Eventually, the many impeachment resolutions that were introduced in the House of Representatives seemed to induce the president to release the tapes Cox had insisted on. Yet the Post remained under attack, and the attack was becoming much more public. By this time, I had warmed up to a degree of toughness of which I probably wouldn't have been capable the year before. I am not a good combatant. Generally, I hate fights and would like to run from them, but when there is no choice, I feel able to take action. I was much more willing to go on the offensive than to be defensively polite, particularly in my letters to readers and others who wrote complaining about our coverage. For example, whereas earlier I may have been somewhat sympathetic with readers who wrote about the sharpness of Herblock's pen, in the later stages of Watergate, I had no patience with those who complained that he was being unfair to the president. To one scathing letter, I responded, "We have been heavily attacked for biased reporting by many individuals who, when confronted with the facts, have since resigned from the government." I wrote to a man in Florida in October 1973, facetiously thanking him for sending me a copy of an ad from the Miami paper suggesting that we belonged in jail, and asking him, "If we are exaggerating minor peccadilloes, why has the majority of the White House staff had to be unloaded?" At some point, I even engaged in a behind-the-scenes back-and-forth with Claire Booth Luce. Personally, I admired her, but I was not in accord with her extremely conservative views. She sometimes over-dramatized things in speeches. In a major address to the Newspaper Publishers Association convention, she said she had written a speech, but was troubled about it and thinking about it as she went to bed. That night, she said, the spirit of her late husband, Henry Luce, came to her and told her to tell the truth about Watergate. She then attacked the Post for our reporting and for hiring enemies of the president. After the speech, I told a friend that Phil Graham had appeared to me in the night and told me to tell her to shove it. On December 28th, I was lunching outside the building, a rare occurrence, with Meg and Phil Jalen at an Italian restaurant when I got called to the telephone by Alexander Haig, who was then White House Chief of Staff. He was calling from Nixon's California home, or the Western White House, as it was called, since the president spent a great deal of time there. I vividly recall sitting on the stairs in a dark, narrow passageway where the phone was located, furiously scribbling notes on a scrap of paper I'd hastily grabbed from my purse. Haig heatedly complained about two page-one stories by Woodward and Bernstein. The first had said that Operation Candor, the name that had been given to the president's attempt to defend himself, had been shut down, and that two of the president's closest advisers, who had stuck by him, no longer believed in him. The second story said that the president's counselors had been supplying lawyers for Haldeman and Ehrlichman with documents and evidence that the White House was submitting to the special prosecutor's office. Haig was outraged, calling the articles scurrilous and untrue, and referring to the second piece as a patchwork of thievery. Late in January 1974, I went to a dinner at the Clark McGregor's for the new vice president and Mrs. Gerald Ford, which says a lot about where McGregor was, at least by then. It's interesting, too, that the Fords were willing to have dinner with me, even though he was Nixon's new vice president. Also, I was seated at dinner next to Haig, who seemed to be feeling more friendly toward me with each new revelation from the White House. The following week, on February 6th, members of the House of Representatives voted 410-4 to proceed with the impeachment probe and to give the Judiciary Committee broad subpoena powers. Trying to keep all his hatred of the press and particularly of the Post within the confines of the White House proved too much for the president. He attended Alice Roosevelt Longworth's 90th birthday party and told reporters waiting outside that she had no doubt managed to keep young by not being obsessed by the Washington scene, adding, if she had spent all of her time reading the Post or the Star, she would have been dead by now. Later in February, Haig invited Meg, Ben, and me to lunch at the White House, clearly a kind of reaching out. The whole feeling in early 1974 was the opposite of what we had experienced during the preceding months of strain, worry, and anguish. By this time, we were all undoubtedly on a high because we had been vindicated. Still, our satisfaction was to a large extent vitiated by dismay at the extent of what really was going on in the Nixon White House. After I'd been to the country for the weekend, Meg asked me, with just the right note of incredulity in her voice, "Have you heard the latest?" and then proceeded to tell me of the backdating of the deed for the papers Nixon had given as a gift to the National Archives for the proposed Nixon Library. The deed had been falsely backdated to before the effective date of a law curbing tax deductions for such gifts. Nixon had claimed deductions of nearly $500,000 over 4 years. I also remember that my reaction then was, "How wonderful!" I realize that sounds vindictive, but the fact is that after we had been under assault for so long, it naturally felt good to have such revelations unfolding one after another, far beyond our reporting or even our wildest imaginings. Meg said, "The next time you make one of your speeches saying, 'This certainly gives us no satisfaction, we are only doing our bounden duty,' God will strike you dead." Again, we were happy to have everything corroborated further when on March 1, 1974, indictments were handed down by a grand jury for 7 former Nixon administration and campaign officials for allegedly conspiring to cover up the Watergate burglary. What next? On May 9th, the House Judiciary Committee began formal hearings on the possible impeachment of Nixon. Though some of my friends, including Andre Meyer, suggested that the Post was trying to extract every last drop of blood from the president, I believed that we were following and reporting the impeachment process in a reasoned and dispassionate way, and replied to Andre, "I hardly see how anyone, no matter how ill-intentioned, could pervert this to extracting every last drop of blood. It really has more to do with what is best for the country now and in the future than it has to do with this president, who no longer matters, whereas the country does." Privately, I felt that impeachment was right, but my personal opinion didn't get mixed up in the paper's ongoing reporting. In mid-May, it was revealed that Nixon's talk with Haldeman and Dean about economic retaliation against the Washington Post Company's television station licenses had been cut from the tape before its release. This was widely reported in the papers, including our own. As a result, I received a contrite letter from Joe Alsop, who on the whole had continued to stick by the president, and with whom I had had a serious argument about whether the administration was connected to the license challenges. Joe wrote me, "You're dead right, and I was nearly dead wrong. This was my first reaction to the extraordinarily interesting story by Bernstein and Woodward on the president's threat of retaliation against the Post. I cannot tell you how much I admire the enormous courage that you have all shown, particularly you and Ben. Whether the final outcome will be happy, I cannot possibly say, and I sometimes have my doubts. But the fact is that a very dangerous system had grown up in the White House, which would have threatened this country if it had continued. It was destroyed by you and the other leaders of the Post, and the Post reporters, almost single-handed. So I send you all my warmest congratulations, and also my apologies for giving our miserable president the benefit of the doubt, which now turns out to be a completely wrong thing to do." It was a generous letter from Joe, one I'm sure he wrote with a great deal of sadness and lamentation for something irretrievably lost. Watergate continued on its way toward an ending none of us could have imagined 2 years earlier. Even as late as the summer of 1974, amazing as it may seem after all that had been revealed and all the constitutional processes that had taken place, the grand juries, the courts, the congressional committees, Nixon was still blaming the press for his predicament, saying at one point that if he had been a liberal and bugged out of Vietnam, the press would never have played up Watergate. Despite Nixon's protestations to his supporter Rabbi Baruch Korf that Watergate would be remembered as the broadest but thinnest scandal in American history, it went on being revealed as anything but. On July 8th, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments in a historic special session in the case of the United States versus Richard M. Nixon. What was at stake was whether the court would order the release of the White House tapes. The next day, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Peter Rodino divulged many of the differences between what the White House had released and what the committee had found on certain tapes, indicating that Nixon had played an active role in the cover-up, which was still going on. On July 24, 1974, events moved inexorably forward as the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Nixon had no right to withhold evidence in criminal proceedings and ordered him to turn over the additional White House tapes that had been subpoenaed by Jaworski. On July 27th, 29th, and 30th, respectively, the House Judiciary Committee adopted three articles of impeachment, charging President Nixon with obstruction of justice, failure to uphold laws, and refusal to produce materials subpoenaed by the committee. Editorially, the Post did not come out for resignation, as many other papers did. We believed, as an independent paper, that people would behave wisely and judiciously if given the information necessary to make their decisions, and that the process should be allowed to work. Finally, on August 5th, the long-anticipated smoking gun turned up. Three new transcripts were released by the White House, recounting conversations between Nixon and Haldeman on June 23, 1972, 6 days after the original break-in. The tapes showed that the president had personally ordered a cover-up and that he had directed efforts to hide the involvement of his aides in the break-in through a series of orders to conceal details about it known to himself but not to the FBI. This was such a dramatic and obviously final development that I left Martha's Vineyard, where I had gone for my August vacation, and flew immediately to Washington. Nixon initially said that he would not resign, that he believed the constitutional process should be allowed to run its course. All 10 Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee who had voted against impeachment then announced they would vote in favor of at least the obstruction of justice article. We led the paper with the possibility of Nixon's resignation, but made no predictions, despite speculation on every side. On August 8th, President Nixon announced that he would resign the next day. I stayed at the paper all that day. Together, many of us watched Nixon's television appearance about his decision to resign. Phil Jalin had dinner at the Madison Hotel, across the street from our offices, and wrote on a napkin a rough draft of an editorial on the resignation. When it was typed, he sent it to me with a note. "This is one you probably would want to take a look at." On August 9th, the Post produced a 22-page special section on the Nixon years. Along with a few people in my office, I watched the weird speech Nixon made before leaving the White House, fairly incoherently talking to his staff in the East Room about his mother, who seemed to be on his mind a great deal. The unreality of the whole thing hung all around us. After the long months that had stretched into years, it was so strange to be watching what none of us had ever imagined happening. It all seemed both world-shattering and confusing. A miracle of sorts had taken place. This country was about to change presidents in an utterly democratic way, with the processes that had been put into place 2 centuries before working in this unprecedented situation. At the Post, we received a lot of unpleasant phone calls, many readers expressing the sentiment that they imagined we were all popping champagne corks to celebrate the result we had wanted from the beginning. In short, the "I hope you're satisfied" school of thought. What I mostly felt was relief mingled with anxiety. Until the smoking gun tape had turned up, nothing had been certain. Right up to the last few days of his presidency, it seemed possible that Nixon could hold on. Now the unease about where all of it was leading was over. Immediately after watching Nixon's speech, and before he'd left Washington, I returned to the vineyard to continue my vacation. When I got back to the quiet of my house there, on the island that always gives me a sense of peace and remoteness from everyday life, I turned on the television and heard a voice referring to President Ford. It was quite shaking. Then and only then did I experience pure relief. I actually felt a weight leave my shoulders. It was over. Nixon was gone. Ford was president, and indeed our long national nightmare was over. The relief came from having a nice, open, honest, and non-threatening president. One of the final touches to Watergate occurred just after Nixon had left Washington. Bob Woodward came to my office with the most wonderful present, an old-fashioned wooden laundry wringer. It was signed by the 6 men who had worked throughout those years to keep the story alive. Ben and Howard, Bob and Carl, Harry Rosenfeld, and Barry Sussman. I loved having this symbol, so indicative of the pressure we had felt during Watergate. An antique dealer had called Bob to say he would be willing to sell the old ringer in case he wanted to consider giving it to me. Ever cautious, Bob had asked how much. 10, the man replied. 10 what? Bob asked. $10, came the answer. Bob snapped up the deal, and I received the much-cherished wooden ringer that sits in my office still over 20 years later. When I returned to Washington in September, I thought life might finally get back to normal after 2 solid years of constant stress over Watergate. Little did I realize that the normal I was thinking of had wholly changed. What I wanted was to be out of the limelight, and I wanted the paper to be out of it, too. But that was far from what happened. To begin with, we still had the challenges to our stations hanging over our heads. The denouement finally came at the end of 1974. The Miami challenge was withdrawn November 26th, and one of the Jacksonville ones in January 1975. The other two were denied by the FCC in April and July 1975, the judge ruling that because of overt deception practiced in the filing of the St. John's application, no finding could be made that the grant of its application would be in the public interest. Again, we were fortunate that the challengers seemed so sure of winning through their political connections that they really never made any kind of a case. More even than Nixon's resignation, this was the end of Watergate for us. By then, we had been fighting this battle against venality for 2 years in the case of 2 of the challenges, and 2.5 in the latter 2. We had paid a heavy price, not only in money, but in concern, distraction, and erosion. On December 5th, 1974, both Ben and I were invited to a dinner at the Ford White House, where I was seated at the table with the new president, an exciting symbol that the whole sad affair of Watergate was over. An amusing sidelight on Ford's elevation to the presidency came when T-shirts were printed with his picture on them, together with the caption, "I got my job through the Washington Post," a slogan also used by our classified ad department. By then, Ford had granted a full, free, and absolute pardon to Nixon, which I thought premature, believing that he should have extracted at least some sort of admission of guilt for it. I suspected that more awful deeds lurked unexposed, now likely never to surface. I'm sure Ford was under a lot of pressure to get the whole disastrous affair behind us. But Nixon's associates paid an even higher price than he did. Resigning the presidency was a high price indeed, but his associates mostly went to jail, whereas he was able eventually to work his way back into being some sort of elder statesman, even contributing to thinking about foreign policy in the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. By the end of 1973, we, the paper and certain individuals on it, began to get a number of awards. As I wrote someone, it is a happy problem. I picked up 2 of the biggest press awards, the John Peter Zenger and the Elijah Parris Lovejoy. I think some of these awards should have gone to others, particularly Ben, which I believe didn't happen because a kind of reverse sexism was at work. Fortunately, who got what award didn't cause any kind of problem in Ben's and my relationship. In fact, when early in 1974 a media industry newsletter named me Outstanding Newspaper Executive, with Ben as runner-up, I found it especially ironic, since I was still having nothing but travail as a newspaper executive. I realized, however, that Watergate was on everybody's mind at the time, and the editors of that report didn't look at the overall picture. In fact, my relationship with Ben was solidified forever by Watergate. I relied heavily on him throughout. More than ever, he was the gung-ho, charismatic leader, remaining cool and courageous no matter what we were hit with. As Woodward later said, there was always a sense that Bradley's our leader. He's the guy who's planting the flag. Ben's personality was and is so up that I would go to see him sometimes just because a visit was reassuring. In addition, I almost always learned something new from him. Rumors swirled around us that I was going to get rid of him, that he had gone too far in reporting Watergate. When this kind of rumor circulates, denials win you nothing. The rumors get recycled even though the person stays on and on. There were also numerous sexist comments on our relationship. Somehow it always seemed to be depicted in exaggerated ways. For example, I wrote Tom Winship after a piece had appeared in the Boston Globe on Ben Bradley and Abe Rosenthal, complaining, "Why is it if a female publisher and a male editor get along, he is accused of stroking and she of being susceptible to manipulation?" The fact is, I always loved working with Ben, and this period, even with its many strains, was probably the most rewarding time of all. In keeping with our established tradition of writing each other end-of-the-year letters, I wrote to Ben at the end of that momentous year of 1974. This letter summed up many of my innermost feelings about what we'd been through together. "This year I'm not going to wait for yours, because I began to think while dressing about the past year, and by the time I got to my shoes I had to grab the pad and begin, as I thought of your remark yesterday afternoon that it was that time of year. The first thing you and I have to do is separate myth from reality, because after this year the myth will start to grow and reality will start to diminish, even in our minds. The reality is so much less pretentious, but so apparently impossible to describe. And it really is much nicer, because it's human. You are now supposed to be a hero, and I a heroine by many, and the opposite by many. I think heroes and heroines are both vulgar and boring, and usually lead that kind of lives. But when you tell people you were just doing your own thing in an admittedly escalated situation, they say, 'Ah, yes, etc.' So what are the realities? They are so complicated, of course, because we have known each other, and our lives have impinged on each other, with almost Proustian coincidence, both closer and more distant than they'd think. Closer, because I am thinking of the shared Walter and Helen Lippmann-type memories, the first tour at the Post, Phil and me seeing you and Jean in Paris, leading up obviously to the drama of Newsweek, followed by the horror years viewed so differently at the time, and then Phil's death. You have to remember, at that time we hardly knew each other, and certainly not in reality or very favorably either. How could the rest have happened? It couldn't ever again. We were still small enough as a company, still private, and so the impossible happened. I, with nothing more than a family feeling, a passion for newspapers, and this newspaper in particular, not the slightest clue about business, broadcasting, or Newsweek, only negative vibes about the latter, which was associated only with madness in my mind, took over this peculiar and charismatic entity. 2 years later, you knocked, typically brashly, intuitively, humorously, rudely, perceptively, far-sightedly, ballsily, and pushy as hell. And because this was a not unfamiliar syndrome to me, and one whose merits and drawbacks I knew, I nodded a feeble assent. I guess that's slightly exaggerated, I say hastily, for all those future fucking Columbia Journalism Review stories. But there's a kind of core truth to the scene. Then came another, the years of learning, of stumbling, of fun, of some achievement, progress, mixed with big smelly eggs on the floor, laid and cleaned up or just shoved under the rug until the stain soaked through. The fascinating thing, and the thing to remember, is that if you have enough going for you in the way of momentum and luck, everyone looks at the developing pattern on the rug, whether it's an oriental design or the stain from the egg, and says, "What a beautiful rug." And pretty soon we're telling ourselves, "It's a hell of a rug we've made." And even funnier, it is. But let's always remember the stains, the unfinished work, with the total effect and the fun. My God, the fun. It's unfair. Who else has fun? And that's my Christmas thanks to you, kid. More than even the Watergates, although that too. The things that people don't know, that I know, are style, generosity, class, and decency, as well as understanding of other people's weaknesses. It was out of all these many things that Watergate evolved for you and for me, and for the way it worked. If there was one thing I thought of at the time, it was a high wire over a canyon in which I almost couldn't pull at your coattails and say, "Are we all right? Because if we're not, look below." It was sort of like trying to talk to the pilot during a hairy landing, not that I didn't, and that you didn't respond to the feverish "Are we all rights?" and "Whys?" And maybe one of the things it's easy to forget in 1974 is that the answer was, we were not all right. We were righteous, but mercifully stupid. We were only saved from extinction by someone mad enough not only to tape himself, but to tape himself talking about how to conceal it. Well, who could have counted on that? Not you and not me. Thank God for the reality. It will never be in any book or any cruddy movie. It's much too good for that. Ben's letter to me at the end of that year concluded, "We probably won't live to see another year like 1974. He was quite right. Earlier, in the spring of 1974, at a time when the story had advanced considerably, but was still months short of its dramatic conclusion, Woodward and Bernstein had published All the President's Men, their first book on Watergate. The paperback rights alone sold for $1 million. Ironically, the $1 million came their way at the time of a strike by the Newspaper Guild. I vividly recall watching a news broadcast that showed the two of them leaving the building with their files, and I caused a stir with a rather acid remark about their being the only two people ever to have made $1 million while on strike. From the beginning, there had been talk of a movie. Once Woodward and Bernstein sold the movie rights to All the President's Men to Robert Redford, who intended to play Bob Woodward, there was a great deal of fun and funny speculation, both in the Post's newsroom and elsewhere, about who would play whom in the movie. I jokingly told a group of circulation managers at an association meeting that I had been assured by the editors that my role will be played by Raquel Welch, assuming our measurements jibe. In many ways, the idea of a movie scared me witless. Despite Redford's assurances that he wanted to make a good movie about the First Amendment and freedom of the press, I was naturally nervous about having the image and reputation of the Post in the hands of a movie company whose interests did not necessarily coincide with ours. I couldn't visualize how he and his producers would deal with as complex an issue as press freedom in a dramatic story on the big screen. Someone had to set the ground rules for what they could and couldn't do. I was particularly concerned about the effect of the movie, and our portrayal in it, on the political scene. As public people, which by then many of us at the Post were, we had no control over the use of our names, but there was a great deal of discussion in the beginning among all of us, our lawyers included, about whether the name of the Post should be used. Many of those on the business side of the company said no. Ben's argument in favor of its use was one with which there was widespread agreement in the newsroom. "Whatever we're going to get whether they call it the Post or the Bugle." To help calm my nerves and provide some assurances that the producers had every good intention, Bob and Carl brought the Redfords to breakfast at my house in May of 1974, just as plans for the movie were getting underway. I should have been pleased and interested to meet Redford, but we didn't get along, thanks partially, I'm sure, to my own defensive crouch, the result of all my concerns, however real or imagined. He knew how much I wanted to keep a low profile, both for me and for the paper. On the other hand, Alan Pakula, the director, and I became great friends and have remained so. Redford later gave an interview describing our meeting at breakfast. "It was brittle. That's the best way I can describe it. She was gracious, but tense. There was a definite tight-jawed blue blood quality to Graham that cannot be covered by any amount of association with Ben Bradley or other street types. She said she did not want her own name or that of the Post used. I told her that was impossible. She was a public figure, and in its own way, so was the Post. I respected her for not wanting her privacy invaded, but we weren't interested in her personal life. And I was puzzled. If she wanted to maintain so low a profile, why did she keep making speeches and accepting awards?" Ben sent me a copy of this acerbic interview, to which I responded, "I don't want to be too neurotic, but it reinforces paranoia, no? He's got a point about my ambivalence, which was and is real." I was already worried about the effect of the use of the Post's name when I opened a magazine one day and read that the movie would be filmed in the Post's city room. Within minutes, I was on the phone to Bob Woodward, to whom I exploded with outrage at the idea of our newsroom as a backdrop for the movie. Among all the evils I was imagining was how little work would get done under such circumstances. Bob told me he'd never heard me so angry. In the end, we didn't allow filming in the newsroom. Redford's people had arrived independently at the conclusion that it would be too disruptive for them as well. Instead, an exact duplicate of the Post's newsroom, including the stickers on Ben's secretary's desk, was created in Hollywood, for a mere $450,000, it was reported. And in the interests of authenticity, several tons of assorted papers and trash from desks throughout our newsroom were shipped to California for props. We did cooperate to the extent of allowing the filmmakers to shoot the entrance to the newspaper building, elevators, and certain production facilities, as well as a scene in the parking lot. At one point, I got a message from Redford that they had decided not to shoot the one scene in the movie in which I was to be portrayed. I was told that no one understood the role of a publisher, and it was too extraneous to explain. Redford imagined that I would be relieved, which I was, but to my surprise, my feelings were hurt by being omitted altogether, except for the one famous allusion to my anatomy. The next I heard from Redford was a phone call saying he was sending a preliminary print of the film for us to see, and that we could still ask for changes, which I felt was a charade. In March 1976, several of us went to the viewing in Jack Valenti's screening room at the Motion Picture Association. Because we were all so nervous, we sat in pockets around the room. When the movie ended, there was dead silence. Finally, Redford got up and said, "Jesus, somebody say something. You must have some reaction to it." Then there was a lot of nervous babble. In fact, I loved the movie. I wrote Redford afterwards, sending the letter via Woodward. I suddenly realized that the impact of the movie as we saw it, with you and with each other, was so great, and we were all so tense, that I have never told you what I thought of it. It's just extraordinary in every way. You really did what you told me you were trying to do, and I thought impossible, but you did it. It proves a lot of things that defy reason. My reasoning was that the story couldn't be laid out straight, because if you did, it would bore people, and if you had to hype it, it would hurt the paper. My other concerns for the paper and all our lives were no doubt overdrawn, but real. I'm only sorry about them because I'm afraid I let them interfere with the kind of simple, direct relations I usually enjoy and value. So I want to be very sure you know that I deeply admire what you did in creating All the President's Men. It pictures Carl and Bob almost eerily as I perceive them. They are tenacious, able, complex, intelligent, and wise beyond their years, funny and nice. Incidentally, they have also withstood fame sensibly and decently. It really does tell people what a newspaper is like, the important thing I thought you couldn't do. We are grateful for the vision you had, for all the incredible hard work, financial investment, passion for your profession, consuming attention to detail, all those things we all strive for. And most of all, the love and care that makes the movie one of which we will all be proud, always. To pile one irony on another, the world premiere of the movie took place in April at the Eisenhower Theater at the Kennedy Center, next door to the Watergate, and President Ford sent me tickets for the presidential box, along with the key to the refrigerator in the box, which contained champagne for me and my guests, with his compliments. The movie's effect on us at the Post was electric, yet a little like a bite from the apple of discord. Maybe it wasn't just the movie, but rather the outcome of Watergate itself. Sometimes the gods give us too much and then exact a price. I suggest this discord because the portrayals in the movie of the roles various people had played had a negative effect on several real-life relationships. The movie gave everything to Ben, largely because that made for a simpler storyline, and because he was played by Jason Robards. But of course that wasn't Ben's fault. Howard Simons was made quite bitter by the movie. He was poorly treated, all for the sake of clarity and simplicity. Much of what he had actually done throughout Watergate was divided up in the movie between Ben and Harry Rosenfeld. Barry Sussman was left out altogether, which must have hurt his feelings even more than mine were hurt by having been omitted. Alan Pakula later justified my exclusion by pointing out that I figured only marginally in the book as well. Although Ben's and my relationship had been strengthened by Watergate, others were not so lucky. The relationship between Howard and Ben, which had been so generous and fruitful, was never the same again. Meg described it best later when she said, "We had had a lot of fun together. There was trust and affection among us. That came apart in many complicated ways. People got on each other's nerves. Everybody would claim a different reason for it, Each of us would claim we were without sin. As a story, Watergate was in many ways a journalist's dream, although it didn't seem that way in those first months when we were so alone. But the story had all the ingredients for major drama, suspense, embattled people on both sides, right and wrong, law and order, good and bad. Watergate, that is, all of the many illegal and improper acts that were included under that rubric, was a political scandal unlike any other. Its sheer magnitude and reach put it on a scale altogether different from past political scandals, in part because of the unparalleled involvement of so many men so close to the president, and because of the large amounts of money raised, stashed, and spent in covert and illegal ways. This was indeed a new kind of corruption in government. Even today, some people think the whole thing was a minor peccadillo, the sort of thing engaged in by lots of politicians. I believe Watergate was an unprecedented effort to subvert the political process. It was a pervasive, indiscriminate use of power and authority from an administration with a passion for secrecy and deception and an astounding lack of regard for the normal constraints of democratic politics. To my mind, the whole thing was a very real perversion of the democratic system, from firing people who were good Republicans but who might have disagreed with Nixon in the slightest, to the wiretappings, to the breaking and entering of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, to the myriad dirty tricks, to the attempts to discredit and curb the media. As I said in a speech at the time, it was a conspiracy not of greed, but of arrogance and fear by men who came to equate their own political well-being with the nation's very survival and security. The role of the Post in all of this was simply to report the news. We set out to pursue a story that unfolded before our eyes in ways that made us as incredulous as the rest of the public. The Post was never out to get Nixon, or, as was often alleged, to bring down the president. It always seemed to me outrageous to accuse the Post of pursuing the Watergate story because of the democratic bias of the paper. A highly unusual burglary at the headquarters of a national political party is an important story, and we would have given it the same treatment regardless of which party was in power or who was running for election. I was often asked why we didn't cover Ted Kennedy's debacle at Chappaquiddick as fully as we were covering Watergate. The point is, we did. And the further point is that the Kennedys were probably as angry at us then as the Nixon administration was. Throughout Watergate, I was amazed at the regular allegations that somehow we had created the agony of Watergate by recklessly pursuing certain stories and thereby causing the turmoil that the president was in. How could anyone make this argument in light of the fact that the stories we reported turned out to be true? In the end, Nixon was his own worst enemy. The Post had no enemies list. The president did. Nixon seemed to regard the Post as incurably liberal and ceaselessly anti-administration. In fact, the Post supported a great many of his policies and programs, but his paranoia, his hatred of the press, his scheming, all contributed to bringing him down, helped along by the appropriate constitutional processes, including the grand juries, courts, and Congress. Woodward and Bernstein were critical figures in seeing that the truth was eventually told, but others were at least as important. Judge Sirica, Senator Sam Ervin and the Senate Watergate Committee, Special Prosecutors Cox and Jaworski, the House Impeachment Committee under Representative Peter Rodino. The Post was an important part, but only a part, of the Watergate story. My own role throughout Watergate is both easy and hard to define. Watergate, no doubt, was the most important occurrence in my working life, but my involvement was basically peripheral, rarely direct. For the most part, I was behind the scenes. I was a kind of devil's advocate, asking questions all along the way, questions about whether we were being fair, factual, and accurate. I had a constant conversation with Ben and Howard, as I did with the top two editorial writers, Phil and Meg, so I was informed in general. As was my habit before Watergate, I often attended the daily morning editorial meetings, where the issues were regularly discussed and where editorial policy was formed. What I did primarily was stand behind the editors and reporters in whom I believed. As time went on, I did this more publicly, defending us in speeches and remarks to groups around the country, indeed internationally as well. My larger responsibility was to the company as a whole, beyond the paper, and to our shareholders. I have often been credited with courage for backing our editors in Watergate. The truth is that I never felt there was much choice. Courage applies when one has a choice. With Watergate, there was never one major decisive moment when I or anyone could have suggested that we stop reporting the story. Watergate unfolded gradually. By the time the story had grown to the point where the size of it dawned on us, we had already waded deeply into its stream. Once I found myself in the deepest water in the middle of the current, there was no going back. It was an unbelievable 2 years of pressured existence, which diminished only a little as other publications joined us and as the separate investigations and the court cases spawned by Watergate began to confirm and amplify our reporting. When it was perfectly obvious that our existence as a company was at stake, we of course became embattled. Watergate threatened to ruin the paper. The Post and the Washington Post Company survived partly because of the great skill and tenacity that our reporters and editors and executives brought to bear throughout the crisis, and partly because of luck. In fact, the role of luck was essential in Watergate, and luck was on our side. One has to recognize it and use it, but without luck, the end result for us could have been very different. From the first incident of the guard finding the taped door at the Watergate building, to the police sending to the scene of the crime a beat-up-looking undercover car that was cruising in the area, rather than a squad car that might have tipped off the burglars, to the sources willing, some even eager, to talk and help, we were lucky. We were lucky that the original burglary took place in Washington and was a local story. We were lucky that those under investigation compounded their own situation by further mistakes and misassessments. We were lucky we had the resources to pursue the story. We were lucky that both Woodward and Bernstein were young and single, and therefore willing and able to work 16 and 18-hour days, 7 days a week for months on end, at least with fewer repercussions than married men might have had. We were lucky Nixon was eccentric enough to set up a taping system in the White House, without which he might have completed his term. We were also lucky that none of us went over the precipice under the staggering pressures. During the summer of 1973, the strain on Ben was so great, his responsibility for all the people under him, for being right, for being accurate, that his eyelid began to droop. A doctor told him it might be a serious symptom, indicating a brain tumor or an aneurysm. After 10 days of torture from the suspense, it turned out to be a nervous condition. The calmer people look and act under extreme pressures, the more likely they are to pay the price with physical symptoms. Watergate was a transforming event in the life of the Washington Post, as it was for many of us at the paper and throughout journalism. Anything as big as Watergate changes you, and I believe it changed not only the Post and me, but journalism as a whole. There were both positive and negative effects. At the Post, Watergate tested our whole organization, our talents, our skills, our ability to organize and mobilize resources to handle a long-term major investigation while still covering the daily news. Ultimately, Watergate showed what could be done by reporters arduously and painstakingly pursuing investigative work, by editors remaining skeptical and demanding and as dispassionate as possible under the circumstances, and by editorial writers helping to keep the questions foremost in the minds of our readers. More important in terms of its effect, Watergate catapulted the Post to true national and international prominence. The paper became known throughout the world because of it. On one level, the changed image of the Post was flattering. On another, it was both disturbing and distracting to getting on with other things, as I wrote Dennis Hamilton of the London Sunday Times. The positive press we began to get was heady and head-turning stuff, but the world, fortunately, has a way of keeping one humble. If the world didn't do it, I was determined to remind all of us of the need, as I said in a letter to Carl and Bob, to keep the demon pomposity in control. The sound of our own voices, while listened to by us with some awe and even some admiration, is receding. And if it isn't, there are all sorts of stark realities before us to restore balance and defy hubris. I came to be talked about and written about more and more. I was especially bothered by being talked about as powerful, often referred to in one headline or story or another as the most powerful woman in America, making me feel like some kind of weightlifter or bodybuilder. Actually, I was amazed at this perception relating to power and confounded by how absurd it was to be singling me out as more powerful than Punch Sulzberger or Bill Paley, for example, who controlled more powerful companies but were men. I was also concerned, for the paper and for all of us, including myself, that if your profile gets up too high, it will be a target. Someone or something will bring you down. Accordingly, I did only interviews that I thought were professional and tried very hard to avoid the personal ones. I was fairly confident that the work of Post reporters and editors would withstand critical scrutiny. I once said to Truman Capote that it looked as if either I'm going to jail or they are. On the other hand, I have to admit that I was frightened. I was frightened of the power of a man and his minions, of a president who thought he had the power to wrap himself in the cloak of national security. I was frightened for the future of the Washington Post Company, and particularly after Fritz died and I became chairman as well as publisher, my responsibilities weighed heavily on me. Watergate also changed the way journalism and journalists are viewed, and in fact, the way they work. During the Watergate affair, we, at the Post at least, had developed certain habits that were hard to break. John Anderson, an editorial writer, insightfully discussed this in some notes he made on the editorial page at the time. "We had become accustomed to a high degree of tension and drama. Morning editorial conferences had become obsessive as we went back and forth for hours over each day's events. Quickly they came to take up the entire morning as we sat around Phil's, Jalen, office with the papers spread out before us. The Post's triumph in Watergate is well known, but we paid a large price for it that has had little attention. When it finally ended with Nixon's resignation, life for all of us was suddenly less interesting. For a long time afterward, news coverage was eccentric and spotty, because half the staff, particularly young Metro reporters, were off chasing mini-scandals. It was a matter of years before we got back to consistent, orderly coverage of school boards and county councils." Young people flocked into journalism, some for good reasons and some hoping to be Woodward or Bernstein. Certainly Watergate provided a great deal of evidence that the national media do indeed shape events. Clearly, press reports contributed to Judge Sirica's doubts about what he was hearing in his courtroom, to congressional questions, to public concern. But we don't set out to have such a major impact. No one, least of all the press itself, thinks we are free from errors and faults or completely without bias. I never once have believed that we in the press do everything right, but we try to keep our opinions confined to the editorial page. The natural adversarial relationship between the press and the president was subverted in the case of Watergate, and that too affected journalism. I was somewhat alarmed by certain tendencies toward over-involvement, which I felt we should overcome as quickly as we could. The press after Watergate had to guard against the romantic tendency to picture itself in the role of a heroic and beleaguered champion, defending all virtues against overwhelming odds. Watergate had been an aberration, and I felt we couldn't look everywhere for conspiracies and cover-ups. On the other hand, I don't believe we over-covered Watergate, as some Nixon supporters claimed to the last. As astounding as Watergate was to the country and the government, it underscored the crucial role of a free, able, and energetic press. We saw how much power the government has to reveal what it wants when it wants, to give the people only the authorized version of events. We relearned the lessons of the importance of the right of a newspaper to keep its sources confidential. The credibility of the press stood the test of time against the credibility of those who spent so much time self-righteously denying their own wrongdoing and assaulting us by assailing our performance and our motives. In a speech I made in 1970, before the Pentagon Papers and before Watergate, I said, "The cheap solutions being sought by the administration will in the long run turn out to be very costly. Indeed, they did. Chapter 25. If I'd ever had an inclination to let Watergate and the concomitant fame for the Post go to my head, management problems throughout the company generally, and labor problems, particularly at the Post, at which I was failing dismally, kept me rooted in reality. The problems were entrenched, burdensome, and all-absorbing. I had hoped to get some real help from Paul Ignatius, but that had not happened. Paul was a thoroughly nice, well-intentioned man, but he came from a very different culture and never really learned the communications business. When I decided that we needed a new president of the Post, and when we announced Paul's resignation in October 1971, I viewed it as a failure of all of us in management who had erroneously placed someone in an inappropriate position. Though I never made any major move by myself, particularly changing a top executive, and though much of the criticism I received over the years was deserved, the decisions were always publicly viewed as being only my mistakes. Because of the new conspicuousness of the company and the fact that I was a woman, I got overly lionized for our editorial victories and overly criticized for correcting my mistakes rather than for making them in the first place, both of which I resented. At that time, if a woman fired a man, everyone assumed the woman was at fault. Indeed, I was viewed and publicly pilloried as a difficult, whimsical, tyrannical, tempestuous woman. The man was perceived as a victim. Newspaper executives suffer from press criticism, too. At least I did. In any case, having grown to know the industry and to have slightly more knowledge of what I was looking for, I went outside the company again and hired John Prescott as the new president of the Post, in effect as the general manager. We had upgraded the title to president for Paul because he had been secretary of the Navy. On paper, John looked perfectly qualified. He had had a distinguished newspaper career, starting at the Baltimore Sun 20 years before, and he had spent 4 years on the Detroit Free Press as labor relations manager, which was especially important for what he could bring to bear on our desperate labor situation, as well as 2 years at the Miami Herald, a well-run non-union paper. He had also been general manager of the Knight Ridder papers in Charlotte, North Carolina, and in Philadelphia. Before starting work at the beginning of 1972, John visited the paper and met with the executives, after which he wrote me a fairly accurate appraisal of what he'd seen and what he felt should be done immediately. Since I was more than ready to move us off the mark, I was delighted with his action-oriented approach. I had become more and more aware of the difficulties we were in and was worried about problems on several fronts: the poor labor contracts that seemed to keep us in a straitjacket, the further disintegration of production, the constant crisis management. Getting the paper out each night, as I described it to John, was one last-minute, hair-raising rescue after another taking place, averting either minor or major disasters in breathtaking succession. Despite minor problems, John started to take hold. Although I was puzzled and concerned about certain things he did, I was pleased by a great deal of what he accomplished, some of which had a lot to do with our success in the long run. Within 6 months, he had moved decisively on organizational changes, putting people into more appropriate slots and identifying areas of trouble, all a departure from the past. John brought in Jim Cooper, a young production expert who knew the technicalities of how the machinery worked. He had worked at the Southern Printing and Production Institute, SPPI, an organization that helped train executives to publish in case of a strike. John also brought us Larry Wallace, an able, tough labor negotiator who took the lead in beginning to turn our contracts around. And John replaced our production director with his assistant, a less astute move, but it was hard to find outsiders willing to step into our well-known hornet's nest. With Fritz's death, one learning curve had come to an end. The first 10 years of wading in, of feeling my way, responding to circumstances and problems as they arose. I didn't realize how protected I had been by Fritz. I was now alone again, but in a different way. I became chairman. It never occurred to me to change the gender of what I considered a neutral title, of the board of this growing public company, while remaining publisher of the Post. I was now the person with ultimate responsibility at the Washington Post Company, with all that that entailed. A whole new learning curve faced me. How to be chief executive officer of a public company with obligations to shareholders, how to apply what little I'd learned about management to the business of the company, how to maintain editorial quality while exercising financial responsibility. I felt as though I were lying on a nice bed of nails, inadequate to all of the problems I faced. An affidavit about the hours I was putting into the job would have attested to my good intentions, but results were what I cared about. I didn't know how and when to think about growth, how the job description of a chief executive officer would read, how much profit we should be making, or should be aiming to make. Perhaps my standards were unrealistically high. I was judging myself by the ease with which Phil, at his best, had seemed to deal with his problems, or by some other imagined ideal of what was expected of me. Because I still had vast problems with self-confidence in public situations, I feared dealing with the industry and with Wall Street, especially the excruciating ordeal of speaking to financial analysts. Because we were a public company, if I hashed things up now, the mistakes were all going to be visible. In truth, I didn't even know how much I didn't know, or the complexity of what lay before me. What I did know was that I wasn't at all sure that I could do what was going to be required of me. Good luck was again on my side, coming just when I needed it. It was my great good fortune that about a month after Fritz's death, Warren Buffett bought into the company, beginning a whole new phase of my life. Warren's arrival not only launched me on my new learning curve, but also marked the beginning of a friendship that has gone well beyond the relationship of an owner to a large stockholder. Warren had actually made a cameo appearance in my life in 1971 when he and his business partner, Charlie Munger, came to see me about a possible partnership with them to acquire the New Yorker from Peter Fleischman. The project died, and I didn't see Warren again, or even particularly remember him, until he wrote me a letter 2 years later. This letter is still jokingly referred to by us as the Dear Mrs. Graham letter. Under SEC regulations, anyone buying as much as 5% of the stock in a company is required by law to notify the officers of the company about such a purchase. Warren informed me that through Berkshire Hathaway, he had bought more than 230,000 shares of the Class B shares of the Washington Post Company and intended to buy more. The letter helped explain why he'd bought the stock. This purchase represents a sizable commitment to us and an explicitly quantified compliment to the Post as a business enterprise and to you as its chief executive. Writing a check separates conviction from conversation. I recognize that the Post is Graham-controlled and Graham-managed, and that suits me fine. Some years back, a partnership which I managed made a significant investment in the stock of Walt Disney Productions. The stock was ridiculously cheap, based upon earnings, asset values, and capability of management. That alone was enough to make my pulse quicken and pocketbook open, but there was also an important extra dimension to the investment. In its field, Disney simply was the finest, hands down. Anything that didn't reflect his best efforts, anything that might leave the customer feeling shortchanged, just wasn't acceptable to Walt Disney. He melded energetic creativity with a discipline regarding profitability and achieved something unique in entertainment. I feel the same way about the Washington Post. The stock is dramatically undervalued relative to the intrinsic worth of its constituent properties, although that is true of many securities in today's markets. But the twin attraction to the undervaluation is an enterprise that has become synonymous for quality in communications. How much more satisfying it is going to be to watch an investment in the Post grow over the years than it would be to own stock in some garden variety company, which, though cheap, had no sense of purpose. I am additionally impressed by the sense of stewardship projected by your communications to fellow shareholders. They are factual, complete, and interesting as you bring your established newspaper standards for integrity to the newer field of corporate reporting. You may remember that I was in your office about 2 years ago with Charles Munger discussing the New Yorker. At the time, I mentioned to you that I had received my financial start delivering the Post while attending Woodrow Wilson High in the mid-1940s. Although I delivered about 400 posts per day, My record of loyalty is slightly tarnished in that I also had the Times-Herald route, much smaller, my customers were discriminating, in the Westchester. This was perhaps the first faint sign to keenly perceptive Washingtonians that the two organizations eventually would get together. I should mention that Berkshire Hathaway has no radio or television properties, so that we will not be a complicating factor with the FCC. Our only communications property is the ownership of Sun Newspapers of Omaha, a group of financially but not editorially insignificant weekly newspapers in the metropolitan Omaha.